Hello, everyone, and welcome to Prioritizing, a married couple's faith-based insight into what is most important in education, in marriage, and in life. We are that married couple. I am Michael Pryor, and with me is the lovely Samantha Pryor. Hey, Samantha.
Hello.
All right. Let's do a quick recap, if we could. This is episode 3 of our podcast. Last episode, we talked about building a classroom community. Yes, Samantha?
Yes, we did.
What were some of the things we touched on?
Well, we touched on ways to establish an environment that's supportive of what the kids need, all academically, socially, and emotionally.
Okay, very good. Any loose ends we wanted to tie on that podcast? We touched on a lot.
Yeah, we touched on a lot, but it's also a huge topic that I'm sure there's a lot more that can be discussed at a later time.
Absolutely. There is one thing I did want to mention. We were talking about your classroom specifically. For a reminder, Samantha teaches fifth grade currently, and we're both in Catholic education. A lot of what we say can apply to public education and private as well, but just a lot of our perspectives will tie in our faith into it as well. You were touching on a story about the students sharing their specific skills or gifts. One student played the electric guitar, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
There was one thing you mentioned, and sometimes when we're both talking, we get so focused on what our retort is going to be. It's kind of like a debate almost, where we're so focused on what we're going to say after that we lose sight of what they're still saying. Like, I'll write notes as we're going along, just to give you an idea. And she mentioned something that I just kind of brushed right over. She said, you're trying to teach your students that it's okay to respectfully disagree. You remember touching on that very briefly?
Yeah.
And it was something I'm very passionate about, especially in the political climate we live in, and not that we're going to get into politics by any means, but you look around and people all over the country and even the world, if you have differing opinions, it is no longer acceptable, seemingly, in some instances. The words respectfully disagree aren't in a lot of people's vocabularies anymore, and it's a sad state. And I just wanted to commend you, Samantha, for making instilling that in the students as young as you are.
Well, thank you. And it's not an easy task either. And I don't want to make it sound that every student in my class will always handle their disagreements in a respectful and mature way. But that is the goal. And there's a lot of modeling and prompts and discussions and practicing that we do in our classroom to achieve that goal as much as we possibly can.
Sure. And to share a little tidbit, if I could, for something that happened yesterday that I found very interesting, and it was encouraging, to be honest with you. I'm driving along. It's a beautiful day. It's like 90 degrees yesterday. And my window's down. I have my Michael Bublé blaring down University Boulevard. And a car came up right beside me. And this woman was kind of nodding her head and getting excited with the music I was playing. She had her windows down as well. And she gave me a thumbs up and went driving by me. I noticed on the back of her car were two bumper stickers that were completely differing points of views than I have. And I wanted to see for myself if she saw my bumper sticker. I have two bumper stickers on my car as well that were not in line with hers. So I kind of made it a point to cruise past her again and get in front of her. Didn't cut her off. But I got in front of her so she'd see it, and then I veered to the left, got into the left-hand lane again, and let her get up beside me and see if she had the same demeanor, and turns out she did. She was still very excited about the music. I can only assume that she saw my bumper stickers and was willing to set that aside because we both seemingly had the same taste in music, but I had a very positive takeaway from it. Samantha's laughing because it's a dopey story. What's so funny?
Well, no, also, too, that you just... It's very amicable, but you look for every occasion to find that common ground and not to test other people, but that is something you would do to drive ahead and just make sure she saw it and then to analyze the situation and then to draw a conclusion from it. You just do that all the time. And it's very, I'm laughing because it's funny in a good way.
Okay. Sorry for sharing that, folks. I will keep my personal anecdotes to myself from now on.
No, it's good. I think it's important for our students to see, too, that as adults and in our day-to-day life, that we're able to find common ground, even when our opinions disagree, and that it goes above and beyond just the issue, and treating people with kindness and respect is always the most important thing.
Right. But there are instances when people, or we'll say students in this case, do not treat their peers with respect, or their classroom, or their teachers with respect. Thus enters our third podcast topic, classroom management. Specifically, different behavior systems that are effective in the elementary school level. So let's dive right in. In second grade, I used to teach second grade. A behavior system that I kind of fell into was we had the stoplights. Remember the stoplights?
Yeah.
Red, yellow, green. I'll still debate whether or not that's a yellow light that we drive under or an orange light. We've had that discussion about 100 times. Anyway, the stoplight. The thing that I get the point, you know, green's good and red is not good. There are too few stops on the stoplight. It's either you're good, you're okay, or you're, quote, bad. And that's it, because that's how kids look at it. That's not how I look at it, but kids will definitely look at it from that perspective. The other thing I didn't like about the stoplight was it was in public view, and that was just this system that was used in the school that in the classroom that I fell into, and that's what the grade, the whole level used. So I, you know, team player, going to do what everyone else does, which makes perfect sense. And it's good to have a system that is recognizable to the students. If they're used to that system and it worked, then, you know, the next grade should use it. I mean, it's definitely beneficial. That way it's not, they don't have to learn a new system every year. But in this instance, and that's why my grade level partner and I kind of stemmed away from it after the first year, because we found that students were saying, oh, this kid was on red today, or this kid was on yellow. And we don't want to stigmatize kids at such a young age, because then that's where kids get the idea that I am bad because, you know, I'm on red. And that's not the message we want to pass along to these kids. Any thoughts on the stoplight, Samantha?
No, I completely agree that having a public forum for the students to see one another's behaviors or reprimands is not serving the best interest of those kids. And while you could just do it discreetly, having those three stops is tough because there's no incentives for the expected behavior to go above and beyond. And I don't know how you used it, but I know many teachers I have known in the past have used it where, oh, you're on yellow for the day. And I think it's so important to provide students with an opportunity to learn through their actions and through their mistakes. So if they were on yellow, that they can then earn back to green by fixing that behavior or by correcting the situation.
Sure.
And having those logical consequences to move forward. For many kids, if they get put down to red or yellow or orange, whatever it might be, that could be the end of it for them. That day's shot, their day's ruined, why would I act well?
Yeah, there's no reason to turn that behavior around.
Right.
I see what you're saying.
But I do think that having that consistency across grade levels is important in talking to your colleagues about what they do and what the expectations were for your kids coming in and also going up to the next grade ahead, so that you're bridging that gap and preparing your students for what they need to be successful.
You mentioned logical consequences. For our listeners out there, Samantha is kindly going to fill you in on what that specifically means. Like, what does that mean? I'm sure everyone out there kind of get the gist of it, but give us some examples.
Okay, so in the classroom setting, a logical consequence would be a consequence that matches the behavior and makes sense for the action. So, for example, if I had a student that ripped someone's sheet of paper or tore up a note, the logical conssequence would be to tape it back together or to recreate.
I like that. No, that's great. I think.
But
that's,
to recreate that drawing. So I had a student at one point in time that had a little badge, and another student came and like destroyed it. So they stayed in at recess to remake their own version of the badge, as well as write an apology letter.
Good.
But the logical consequences, it could even be something as simple as knocking over someone else's water bottle. The consequences, you're the one that picks it up. So often I'll stop my students and, you know, I had a student draw a line on someone's paper because they were frustrated and they wouldn't get out of their way. And the one student started to erase it, and I stopped that student and made the other kid erase it and then apologize. So I think just having that consequence match the action and having the students understand that, okay, yeah, this makes sense. You know, if I made a mess, I'm the one that cleans it up.
Got it. So you're saying there essentially there needs to be a correlation between the behavior and the consequence that goes with it.
Exactly. And the students, from my experience, are more accepting of the consequence and are more understanding of that consequence if it makes sense to them. Often, you know, we have different discipline systems school-wide that every school or district uses, but not automatically going to that one and trying to handle the consequences and teaching it as a learning moment for those kids.
Mm-hmm.
Kids are going to make mistakes. It's expected. It's normal.
Adults do.
Adults too. And it's how we learn from them and how we allow that mistake to influence our choices going forward.
So what you're saying essentially is, you know, a kid doesn't do their homework, missing recess for the week, that isn't necessarily a logical consequence.
No, but a logical consequence would be that they have to stay in and complete the assignment, but as soon as it's done, they can go outside. They don't have to miss the whole recess, but they do have to complete their work first. That's the expectation, as long as it's clearly stated and everyone's students, teachers included, know this is how our classroom needs to run to function properly to help support everyone in here.
Right. And let me just say for the record that both Samantha and myself, I'm speaking more from my own personal experiences, you know, we're not the ultimate experts on classroom management, but we can speak from experiences and what has worked in both our accomplishments and our failures. I know I've shared both with Samantha,
mm-hmm.
More so the failures, just because I know there are certain ways to go about things. And it's, as human beings, and this is not by any means a cop-out, because teachers are held to a higher standard because they're entrusted with the lives of 20 or more students every single day. So they do have to be held to the higher standard, put on that facade that we were talking about a couple podcasts ago. You said check your emotional baggage at the door, and
mm-hmm.
I agree with that entirely. There are times, and I've been guilty of this before, one instance in particular comes to mind, I won't get into the details, but where your personal emotions about the situation or how your day is going, and you let that affect how you discipline the students, and then the students are then the innocent bystanders, and they're caught in the crossfire between your own emotions and what's happening in the classroom. And that is something, of course, we're trying to avoid. And we'll just say that my lesson was learned, we'll say harshly, but it was a great experience for me, just because I learned there was a lot to take away from it, I guess I could say.
Yeah, and Michael, I think you bring up a great point, is that, you know, you and I definitely don't know all, and we're the first to admit it, and that by, no matter how many years you've been teaching, it's important to go to those support systems that you have to learn more and to constantly stay up with research and new techniques that will work. But also, I do a classroom management system that slightly varies every single year, because you have to learn that the dynamics of your students are not the same, and your dynamics as the teacher are not the same. Your expectations change year to year based on your comfort level, how many years you've been teaching, and the more you know about the grade and the students' abilities for where they need to be at that point in the year.
Uh-huh.
So I think it's important to realize that classroom management is evolving, and what works one year certainly might not work another year with a different group of kids, that it needs to be fluid and flexible.
Sure. That's it. So the other, next one, and I'll let you jump in after, another system that I've used, and I'm sure many people are familiar with, is the clip chart. You know, you got the nice sayings, whether it's great job or above and beyond or superstar, whatever you want to, however you're, there's about five or six different rungs on your clip ladder, essentially. And the students start on the good or the way to go kind of level, and they can move up for superiority, and they can trickle down the chart. Now, the one thing, again, going back to that light system, the one thing that I do with this chart, and I've seen some teachers do it differently, and that's okay, of course, is some teachers like to have students own the responsibility of having to move their own clip, which I don't necessarily disagree with, but if it's done in front of the class, like if the other students see them moving it, A, they know they're moving it, and then it's like the shame element. And a lot of students, as you get older, will try to save face. Like their peer opinions, as they get older, will matter a lot more than the adult's opinions, sadly. And any parents listening, I'm sure, can attest to this. The not wanting to hug their mom or dad because their friends are watching, that kind of thing. I hope, you know, I don't think our kids will ever be like that.
I hope not.
No, they're not allowed to. Anyway, but the clip chart was good. I used it my last few years when I taught second grade. The difference was I kept the clip chart behind my desk out of sight, so only I could see it, and I would move the clip up or down as I saw fit, but I would always let the students know. Like, I'd pull the student aside, or I'd creep down next to them, and while they were doing a lesson, or while we were in the hallway or something, and I'd make it known to them that they were going up for superiority or going down because they weren't, doing what was expected of them. So I thought it was a way to draw the attention away from shaming the student and just focus on that student, what they got to do better. And they did have opportunities if they went down to go back up. And a lot of students took great pride. Like, it was like, okay, I'm down, no sweat. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. I have all day to get it back up. And I'd make sure I would vocalize that to them.
And the students really look to the teacher, too, to get an understanding of what it means. Because especially at the second grade level, they don't want to disappoint. But a lot of students still at the fifth grade level, while they have that social component where they're caring more about their the opinions of their peers, they also... many of them still want to please the teacher or want to do well. So I think that having that moment to discuss with them, okay, you know what? This is no big deal. I'm not upset about it. You shouldn't be upset about it. I always say that, you know, if tears arise, am I crying? If I'm not crying, you can't be crying, because that means that, you know, we can still fix this. Oh, we can still come forward.
You know what? Can I jump in real quick? I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
This is the big thing too, I find. What I would do when it was my students, because my students knew me well enough and knew how to respond when I was in certain versions of myself. If I was in serious reprimand mode, they knew not to have a smile or a smirk on their faces. But a lot of students, as I see students now in the hallways, or if I saw when I was teaching second grade, if I saw other classes. And I would go to speak to them if they were being knuckleheads in the hallway or something. I'd go to speak to them, and they'd have big grins on their face, and I would say the same thing. You know what? You should try to get in the habit of reading the emotions of the person who's talking to you. And if adult, you know, if I'm smiling, great. I'm obviously sharing some positive news. But if I'm in the serious face right now, you know, that your face should match mine, or at least try to match mine, because the big smile isn't working. Because it shows to the old school disciplinarian, it shows, I think, a lack of respect. Would you agree with that?
I think it can definitely show a lack of respect, but at the same time, knowing that you're talking, not you per se, but just someone talking to a student that's not in their class, or something where the student might not have been expecting it and they thought they could have gotten away with the behavior, it also could just be a level of anxiety or being uncomfortable or even embarrassment too. So I think keeping in mind where that student might be feeling.
Nope, no smiling.
As well. I am one of those people though that sometimes in uncomfortable situations, or if I'm embarrassed, I smile, and it's not the appropriate reaction.
No kidding. Another thing that comes to mind as we're talking about this is I'm reminded, and I learned that this year in particular, my first year as an assistant principal, it became aware to me when I was in the hallway and I'll see students doing something they clearly should not be doing, and I'm the only one there, so I'm going to intervene, and I get the uncomfortable smirks or the scoffing or the eye rolls or what have you. And to me, you know, I'm used to the second graders who were at attention when they needed to be, or not really. I wasn't like Schwarzenegger in Kindergarten Cop or anything, but the students, you know, knew when it was time to have fun, knew when it was time to be all business, and these students in the hallway were you know, kind of brushed me off, essentially, and it didn't make sense to me at first, but then I remembered the you got to have a connection before you make the correction. You've heard that before, Samantha?
Yeah, I have. And I also think it's important, too, that to recognize that right now, you know, you're dealing with students of all ages. And I know for me, I struggle at the fifth grade level sometimes with the attitude and the eye rolls. And it's also developmentally appropriate. You know, it's important to not saying eye rolling is acceptable, but it's normal for a 10-year-old to become frustrated and their emotions are starting to switch so quickly. And they don't always recognize it themselves. So there's this book, Yardsticks, which is great, that discusses the social, emotional, and academic benchmarks of where students should be at different ages. And I find myself referring back to that a lot, especially those days where I'm struggling as a teacher with the behaviors or the attitudes of my students and thinking, like, here I am, you know, I have put so much thought into this and I really targeted this lesson for them, and I just got met with talking and shrugs. And you go back and read that and review, okay, you know what, this is where they are, this is normal, this is nothing personal, it's just the behaviors. Each age has a behavior and those norms where they are developmentally. Second grade very much wants to please, fifth grade wants to please but wants to entertain a little bit more.
And that's where you have the ability, Samantha, to self-reflect and separate your own emotions from what you know, where the students are on individually. So you know some students, the smirk is completely unacceptable because they know better and they never have that behavior. But other students, they're always going to give that to you. So, you know, you just got to deal with it because that's just how the job goes. Something too is, there's a lot of thought out there that all classroom management systems need to be positive, positive, positive. Now, positivity is, I'm all about positivity. Samantha can attest to that when I'm doing my jumping jacks at 5 in the morning when she's trying to sleep and I'm going to work. But that's not always realistic. There needs to be some kind of consequence for behaviors. Otherwise, I think eventually students will become keen to the fact that there's nothing going to happen, essentially. So it's comforting to see you being willing to say, you know what, all students are different. I gotta individualize my approach to their behavior system as well as the academic side. But it's good that you have that ability to self-reflect.
Yeah, and it's important to recognize too that what works for one student doesn't work for another. It goes back to that saying, fair isn't always equal. You know, the needs of one student are different than another. Not saying that one student will get in trouble for something that another wouldn't, but they're not aware of the struggles that their peers are going through. So if one student is having a much harder time, I might be more willing to let some of those behaviors slide and take an easier approach to help reflect. And I think you bring up a good point, Michael, that, you know, yes, positive discipline is important, but positive doesn't necessarily have to be consequences don't necessarily have to be punitive either. Mm-hmm. They could be a chance to reflect, and that's where those logical consequences come in. That, yeah, you know what, this is a serious matter. I'm not laughing. I'm not smiling. We need to learn from this, but it's not necessarily as a consequence where, oh, you have to go, you know, time out for 10 minutes or whatever that might be.
Right.
One way I do this in fifth grade to help really differentiate the needs of different students and help them learn is through a checkbook system, which ties in really well to the level of thinking that we do in fifth grade and math. So each student has a registrar that they add and deduct money to based off of certain behaviors, and it can be used whole group or individually. So we have students earning money as a whole class if we're more talkative, or if they can't get silent within the time frame we've discussed, they can lose money for that behavior. But if it's also just one student or two students shouting out, the whole class doesn't get punished for that. and they're really aware of the behaviors and that just having things be just in the classroom and equal and not so much equal but fair. You know, students hate to lose money for the behaviors of others, or they'll be really quick to applaud that one or two students that have earned money for the whole class by doing the right thing. Occasionally I'll throw out a huge amount and say, oh yeah, you can add $50 or $75, and they're shocked. But I think it's important for them always to see that doing that right thing can be rewarded.
To piggyback off what you were saying there, students getting upset with the actions of others, something that I've always encouraged, and it's tough, this needs to be modeled and reinforced over and over again, like anything else in your classroom, is something I called, and I don't know if I coined this, but I call it polite policing. It's something we use in the classroom. It's pretty simple. If we have a classroom behavior system, like what you had mentioned, taking money away from the entire class, if students are polite policing, that just means, you know, if you see someone not doing what they're supposed to be doing, before that, you know, mean, nasty Mrs. Pryor comes down on everybody, the other student can give a little nudge to the student next to him and say, come on, you know, we're going to lose money. At least then they're taking ownership of the whole class's behavior and realizing it's a team effort, what's happening. Now, it is sometimes it's a real bummer when you're not doing anything wrong. And when you're trying to help the student do the right thing and they still don't, then it's up to the teacher to realize, you know, it's just this one knucklehead doing it. So then maybe it's an individual consequence instead of the whole class. But I say it needs to be modeled and reinforced, because it can't be, if someone's talking across the room, you're not singling out students. It's not meant to embarrass. It's not meant to call kids out. It's meant to really help them. And it's done subtly and pretty much so nobody else can see what's happening. It's a nod, it's a tap, it's a, hey, cut it out. Or the teacher's talking, you know, or the hand's up, we gotta stop talking now. Whatever the case is, it's not meant to, you know, single anybody out or make anyone feel shamefaced.
And I think, Michael, you bring up a really good point, is that allowing the students that leadership to encourage others. I know this year we came up with a silent signal, which is the Pokemon catching symbol. The students voted on it. We talked about it. We modeled what it means and when you should be doing it. And they really do apply it in the hallway, in the lunchroom. Anytime that they need to be silent, they do the silent signal to encourage others, and then everyone else will start doing it. I also have jobs as a part of our checkbook system, and one of those jobs is the classroom lieutenant, where their job is to kind of be the teacher's assistant, and if I'm talking to another teacher or student and a problem occurs, they kind of facilitate what should happen. And they often are walking around the classroom with me trying to do the silent signal or waiting and encouraging positive behaviors of others.
Sure. Now, I don't know what the Pokemon catching signal is, and I'm 100% certain that none of our listeners right now know what that signal is either. And for that, I say thank you. One other system I want to touch on is the word system, team word, fantastic tickets, whatever you want to call it. Samantha, why don't you give us a rundown on that?
So this is a system that I've used in the past that's been really successful, focusing on that positive discipline. Not saying consequences don't come into play, but the consequences are much more individualized based on the scenario. So it starts off with the class deciding a word. And I think whether you're doing checkbooks, stoplight, whatever it might be, it's important to have the interest of the students. So the students would choose on roughly a four-letter word that has to do with their interests. So one year I had taco, another year I had star. And what they'll be doing is earning additional symbols or letters to build off of that word by the end of the day, or losing them based off of whole class behaviors. However, you really focus on individual behaviors by handing out fantastic tickets, which I carry with me as I walk around when we do small group lessons or whole group lessons. And the students will write down their name or number on the fantastic ticket, and they put it into a bin or a jar, whatever you've decided. At the end of the day, however many letters are on the board that the whole class has earned, that's how many individual fantastic tickets you pull out.
Now, Samantha, how do they earn these fantastic tickets?
It can be something as simple as raising their hand when asking a question, or picking up the materials of someone, if someone drops something. It can be any behavior that you are desiring the class to see. And what I'll often do is when students aren't doing what they need to do, I'll hand a bunch to the student who is and draw attention to the positive of what's expected in students that are making the right choice. And then you'll quickly notice that everyone else jumps on board and says, oh, I want fantastic tickets. And then once they do that correct behavior, I'll reinforce it by handing them one or two rather than the 10 or 15 that first student got.
So as the year goes on, is it safe to say that you're more likely to give a lot of tickets out in the beginning of the year, and as the year goes on, you kind of wean them off that?
Of course, and I think when you start the year, it's important to hand out the fantastic tickets for the little things too.
Yeah.
Whereas by the end of the year, you're handing fantastic tickets out for a higher level of participation.
Very good. The last and final thing I'll touch on quickly and then we'll wrap up here is classroom dojo. I've heard good things. I've heard okay things. My only thing with I love how Classroom Dojo updates the parents instantly. So if parents get a stay-at-home mom or a stay-at-home dad who is just home and they want to know how their child's doing, they can get updates. And I think that's terrific. The one spot where I am anti-dojo is for going back to that public shaming aspect. I think if it's used for positive, if it's a classroom system solely, and it's, if the class as a whole is doing poorly and they get dinged or whatever you call it, that's fine. But when there's a name attached to it and everyone else can see it, and they can see that little Samantha's being disrespectful and she gets dinged in front of the class, then she feels about, this big. I'm making the universal symbol for when people say I'm feeling this big, I'm making it really small. You know what I mean? Sure, yeah, they feel very small. And then it just kills their self-esteem, and it's not really a motivator for them to improve. So that's all I have on the dojo. So it can be used for good. I think it has a lot of good possibilities to it. Teachers, just be careful that you're not, you're making your classroom run smoothly. That's super important, but at the expense of what? If you're doing it at the expense of the spirit of our youth, then we have to reconsider our classroom management system.
I agree, Michael. In any classroom management system, there's a chance to handle things discreetly, and there's always that opportunity where you can not humiliate the student, but handle it publicly. And it's really important that, it's no one else's business. This is between me and this one student, and it will be handled privately. It's not up for discussion. It's no one else's eyes or ears. They don't deserve to know. So I think with dojo, it just needs to be handled that same way.
Yeah.
And one thing to mention about that class dojo does well is it does allow that interest piece for the students. They can create their avatar.
Yeah.
It graphs right. Their data for them, which is another great tool as teachers. We're always hyped up on data, and it provides that data for you. So there's those risks with drawing attention publicly, but it's so important that we avoid that temptation no matter how frustrated as a teacher we make it.
And you talked about humiliating the students, not wanting to do that. When I used to speak to students, whether it was on the playground or in the hallway or in the lunchroom, what have you, I pulled them to the side. If other students, whether it was my class or other classes, were walking by, they're always going to stare right at you and stare at the student. And I would always make it a point, and this is, I don't know if this is beneficial or not, but I would look at them and I would say, oh, hi, how are you? Like, call them right out, pretty much saying, I know you're listening, pretty much beat it. Or can I help you with something? Or, mind your biz, whatever, just to give them... let them know that although I'm dealing with this student who's clearly done something they shouldn't be doing, it is not appropriate for you to be nosy about it.
I agree. And also, too, like, one thing I always try to do is when I pull a student aside or in the hall to talk to them in private, is I will not walk right back in. Or if they're telling me about something, I always tell my students, you can come to me, and I take it with a grain of salt. But it's important for them to feel comfortable that if someone's done wrong by them and they need help, that they can talk about it. I do not address the situation immediately following, because
right.
there's no better way to clue in the students that, oh, someone told on me, or
yeah, you want to be
someone
discreet.
Ratted me out. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, great talk, Samantha. It was fun talking about classroom behavior systems.
Yes, it was.
And next week, we don't have, do we know what we're talking about next week? We're both shrugging our shoulders going, I don't know.
We'll come up with something.
Yeah, we'll come up with something terrific for our fourth episode of Prioritizing. Thank you for tuning in, and you'll hear from us again next Thursday. Samantha is being immature and obnoxious right now, which is pretty typical. I know some of you were expecting atypical, but we have fun, and we're really enjoying doing this. Oh, before I forget, I told you I'd give you a review of, what's that book again?
Oh,
The Journal.
The Navigator's Council.
The Navigator's Council. A review, an honest review, is that we're 1 week in, and we just did, I guess you could say, we're starting our second week, so we filled in our answers for the second week. And what the book does, it pretty much asks, it gets an idea of what your schedule's like for the week, so the married couple can coordinate what they're doing. It also asks areas of improvement that are needed, areas to pray for, and things that have brought us joy. And so far, I'd say it takes 10 minutes. It's a good conversation piece, and it actually gets us digging deeper into each other's lives. I mean, we're already pretty over the top involved in one another's lives, which is good because we're married. That's important. But it goes a little deeper, the stuff that we're not always vocalizing for selflessness reasons. We don't want to, you know, weigh our thoughts or our what we might think are unimportant feelings on our spouse. But this gives us an opportunity to do so, and it's been great so far. So if you're looking for something, get the Flight of the Navigators Journal. What's it called?
The Navigator's Council.
The Navigator's Council. I recommend it. It's great. Flight of the Navigator is a movie from my childhood. Samantha still has never seen it. It's a great movie, and we'll have to watch it one day. But until then, I'm Michael, and next to me...
Samantha.
She just hit the microphone again, and
I'm
my blood is boiling. But I love her. And thank you again, and you'll hear from us next week. God bless.